Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and at www.kuci.org. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm very happy to be back after 2 weeks away. It's a delight to be here. The show, in case you're new to it, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and business of writing. Today my guest is Ron Carlson. He's the author of 5 books of fiction, the short story collections The Hotel Eden, which was published in 97, and Plan B for the Middle Class, selected one of the best books of 1992 by the New York Times, and The News of the World, also selected in 1987, and 2 novels, Truants and Betrayed by F. Scott Fitzgerald. His fiction has appeared in Harper's, Gentleman's Quarterly, Esquire, Story, and dozens of other journals and anthologies, including the Norton Anthology of Short Fiction, The Best American Short Stories, and Sudden Fiction. Mr. Carlson has been awarded a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction and the 1993 Plowshares Cohen Prize. A frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review and the Los Angeles Times Book Review, he also hosts Books and Company, which completed its 4th season on KAET Public Television in Arizona. He is professor of English at Arizona State University and lives with his wife, Elaine Carlson, and their 2 sons in Scottsdale, Arizona. Are you there, Ron?
I am.
Great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be on.
Yes. Today I was on the web looking around, poking around for info on you, and I came up with one of your quotes. It was on a quote board, and it said, I always write from my own experiences, whether I've had them or not.
Right.
Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I said that. I said that a long time ago, and I've been explaining it ever since. It's turned out to be something that, of course, the reason I said it was that at the end of a reading somewhere, someone said, do you base your stories on your personal experiences? There are a lot of answers to that question, but that's what I said. I said, "Yeah, I write from my personal experiences, whether I've had them or not." And I realized that that's exactly it. I mean, some of the stories are real close. I've written lots and lots of stories, and some of the stories are real close. I mean, they start almost like a letter from part of my life. I'm working on one right now about the fact that I had the privilege of being the chauffeur, taking my sophomore son and his junior date to this prom a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove an old car, and I ended up spending an hour in the parking lot with the other chauffeur drivers. It made me wish that I smoked cigarettes, because they all had accomplished, they were good at it, and it looked kind of fun. But sometimes you start close. You do write from your own experiences. But other times, something... you get on a track or a take that it's not you, but you're so, and of course as a fiction writer, fiction requires empathy. I mean, you have to sit in all the chairs. If you don't, if you treat anybody in a story as if she or he is another person, that is to say, by that I mean the other, then you're going to get something less than what I'm trying for. I mean, I'm trying to... The other is for genre fiction, and so you sit in all the chairs. And sure, yeah, if you get the gym teacher or the young pregnant girl or the old retiring janitor, whoever it might be, if you get what you expect, you probably haven't done your job. And so you try to live that moment with them and surprise yourself. And the writers I talk to, you always know if you did. I mean, sometimes it's a monologue from some guy you're not. I mean, I've written lots of people. I've written in men's voices, lots of men. Some of them are very similar to me in the life I was leading at the time. Others are women, and they're people, and you have to write carefully. And so, yeah, so I'll stand by it, sure. It kind of got me off the hook because my wife was really hoping that I'd find another family to write about. But, that's the way she put it. But of course, then you plead fiction, which it always is. I mean, it's these stories start out of a strong impulse, and most often that's, for me, not a pure intellectual impulse. It's something that's crossed into my actual vision, and I've been involved with it in some way. But then the things that happen to it, as you're right, of course, you need to be, you listen very closely and follow closely.
Well, something you said a minute ago about empathy, you always hear that you should love all of your characters, even the villains or even the horrible people that find their way into your story. Are you talking about that?
No. Oh, no. I'm not sure I know about that. I mean, in terms of loving them all. I think they all need to be as smart as you are. And I see that sometimes where we have somebody, maybe it's the vice principal of a high school. What did I see the other day? Oh, I see a lot of school teachers who aren't treated very well. I mean, I am one, but I'm not complaining because I've been treated fabulously as a teacher. I've tried to return the favor, but the issue is there's always some smarmy, self-righteous teacher, and they go off on him. No, you don't need to love your characters, but you can't treat them as if they're less than you are. And so with C-Stories, everybody has to be at least as bright as you are, and that's a little bit of a challenge. Then that means the evil developer, you know. Of course, and it's the things I'm talking about when I'm speaking this way are so antithetical to what we see in film and the genre of fiction, which sells so well. Because there we need the other, and we've been lucky lately to have the other be aliens, you know. It's funny, you know. Well, he's from another planet, so we don't care about him. But it's still a fraudulent.
Well, and something else you also mentioned, which is writing in other points of view, the female point of view, mm-hmm. for instance. There's a story in the Hotel Eden, The House Goes Up, which I've read a couple times, and I find really interesting that it's from a female point of view and very much rooted in that. Where did that come from? Where did that story come from?
Well, that's one there. I think there's some other women. In my first book, In the News of the World, there's a psychic who speaks about how it's not really any fun being a psychic. And someone else, I wrote a series of tabloid headlines, which were performed, and they continue to be performed under the title "Bigfoot Stole My Wife," where the people are trying to explain what really happened. So, but in The House Goes Up, that piece is called The House Goes Up, and I've always liked that phrase, and it means that the house is for sale.
Mm-hmm.
But here she's talking about someone else, and I got a speaker in mind, and she was just going on, and I liked her. She was bright, and she was just a half a step ahead of me. And so I wrote that story essentially trying to catch up. There's an interesting phrase. I borrowed a line that I always loved from Pauline Kael, the wonderful film critic for years at The New Yorker, who used, she was comparing, Tuesday Weld and Sandra Dee, and she was dismissing them, and she said, well, cleavage is cleavage, coming or going. And that I gave her a line like that in the story, but it was. I hope you understand what I mean by right. She was a half a step ahead of me. I mean, I thought she was knowing. She was also kind of hurt, and I worked. When you have a story that may be that you may think may be a little premise heavy, I wrote a story called A Note on the Type, which was these stories start off to be kind of takes on things. But the challenge to the writer is to stay in that place until the next thing happens,
mm-hmm.
and you get all of a sudden it's occupied. It isn't just an idea that rings a certain way, but all of a sudden there's people in there. And it's kind of messy, and it's not what you but it's better and it's fuller.
So whether we're talking about The House Goes Up or A Note on the Type, writers are getting ideas all the time. You probably get a million ideas a day. Half a million, 1,000, whatever.
A million ideas a day, that's great.
And so how do you choose which ones you're going to execute, which ones you're going to you're going to work on, what is it about it that makes you pursue?
There's a couple of answers to that. One is, you do. I've written a lot of stories. I don't know, 100 or 100 and something, and it's, I had a wonderful friend who was a screenwriter one time. He was quite successful. He took me to his house. This is years ago. And he showed me his five black notebooks. He got these five. He says, I look at each of the five and I decide which bird to feed. And that was his line. I thought, because I never, people said, well, you must work on more than one project at a time. And I always kind of slide off of that, because I don't. I work on one thing, and I just work at it. I'll talk for a second, Barbara, just about the process, the way I work.
Sure.
That I don't work like 5 hours a day or 8 hours a day or an hour a day, and I take tea at 2:10 from 2:10 to 2:30. I'd like to, and I like tea, but the deal is that what happens is if I'm in a project, I'm just voracious for it. Okay, I'm going to have it. And so I'll work on it straight, 8 days maybe, and that'll be morning, noon, and night, and in between things, and skipping meals, and then I'll work. Then I won't work for 10 days or 20 days, knowing that I'm not waiting like that. And so that's always been the way. There's been external forces, contracts, and things that have adjusted it, but I've looked at each year, and I've been able to maintain a kind of level of being prolific that's working. But these ideas, they choose you in that there has to be, the way I say it is, the way you feel about what you're going into is more important than your understanding of the data. So that we have these interesting experiences. I mean, we've all had them, everybody's had them, but some of them tap you and say, hey, have you got a minute? And then you make your decision. And I never open a story. I never write the first line of a story without knowing that I'm going to get it. I don't know what it'll be. I don't even know sometimes if it's comic or serious, but I know I'll get it. I know I'll come out in 16 days or whatever it is, and I'll have a draft.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's that emotional connection that I'm looking for. Like this thing when I was taking my son to the prom, I was so removed from any. I was the other guy. I mean, they were talking, all four kids in the back seat of this old Chevrolet. You know, it was great. And I'm driving. I'm trying not to listen. I'm doing a good job not talking, which is unusual. And I just love that feeling of being just out. You know, I drove, and the people I spoke to were the valet guys. I said, no, I got it. And all the chauffeur. And I was invisible. It was a dream. It was, it's the beginning of this new chapter in my life, certainly.
Hmm.
So, and I don't know what that story will be, and it won't be called The Driver, but it will be, there will be a scene with a bunch of guys in the dark smoking cigarettes, looking at the country club over there and listening to the music, and a couple of couples on the terrace twisting closer in their embraces. It was really lovely. But, who knows? I know I'm married to it. I'm talking about it because I'm into that piece already.
Yes. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Ron Carlson, author of The Hotel Eden and other books. Speaking of being the chauffeur and how this will become a story at some point, or at least some part of it, does most of your life and your experiences work their way into your fiction in some way?
No, well, I don't know. I mean, I think that's an unanswerable question. I've looked at the things people choose are what really is interesting to me. The filter between a writer, which we all are, everybody, I mean, I've never met anybody who wasn't a writer, and what they choose to say or what they choose to write, and that, I don't know. I mean, I've heard people have come up to me and grabbed me by the shirt and said, oh, let me tell you, and they've told me remarkable things. I mean, I met the guy who invented power steering, and I met other people who landed in this the first wave in France in World War One. This is years ago, but and other things, and they don't stick to you, and other things stick to you. And I don't know what that is, but I think that's what you're, as a writer, I think it's what you're offering. I think it's part of your worldview. I mean, I've had an interesting life in that it has, I mean, I have to go by the empirical evidence. I wasn't particularly privileged. My dad was a welder, and I grew up on the west side of Salt Lake City in this fabulous kind of working class neighborhood. I mean, nobody's, half my friends, their bicycle tires were different sizes, and of course half of my friends did not have bikes. But the evidence, see, I'm 50-something, I'm class of 65, high school, and so the evidence for me is that this is interesting. I mean, I've had a nice time. I mean, I've had a lot of long relationships, and it's, so that comes through. I could try to filter it out and write darker stories, and I've written dark stories, but I want everything in my stories earned. I don't want to throw something in gratuitously because because that's what's happening this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I'm not answering your question.
No, you're answering it.
I think this whole thing of what sticks to us, because it's I talk a lot. I mean, I work with writers all the time, and their choices. It's very interesting that when you work in an MFA program, I've only had one student in the last, say, 4 or 5 years who wrote a book of stories about work. The people in the stories were all working in shipyards, and they were, you know, there was a lot of actual work in the stories.
Hmm.
But I don't know what that means.
Well, going along with this concept of having an idea stick with you, that, you
sure.
know, you go through many things and
yeah.
some stick and some don't. Well, in terms of arc, you know, we talk about the arc of a story.
Sure.
Are you thinking about that when you decide to pursue an idea? Are you thinking about how there is an inbred or inborn arc to whatever it is you're going to write about? Or do you just get there when you get there, or do you just write it and then in the revision process work on it?
That's a really good question. I mean, the issue there is, and I'm going to be just frank with you, you know, school's out, but here's how it goes. I read a lot of stories like you do. I mean, I don't know. There's one year, 95, I read more stories than anybody in the United States. I know it for a fact. I judged several national contests, and I was teaching, da-da-da. But what I want in a story, I'm talking as a reader now. Reading and writing are different activities. They're related in that they meet in the book, but they require totally different instrumentation. And it is, when I read, all I'm asking you in your story is just give me one thing, one good thing that's riveting or engaging, will pay for the rest. And that seems like I'm being oversimplistic, but I mean it. Each year, as I teach and talk and consult and write, my feelings about writing and stories get simpler and simpler and simpler. But when I go into a story, when I start, all I want is a moment that's convincing. I have to believe what I'm doing so that the only interesting thing is the next page to me. I'm only interested in myself surviving the draft. I don't want to perish here. I don't want to go out to Starbucks and sit in the window and announce to the world that I've failed.
Mm-hmm.
I envy those people who have the courage to do that. They all dress better than I do. But the deal is that I want the draft, and so in order to get the draft, I don't think about theme. I don't really think about arc, although I'm experienced as a reader, and I can react to text as well as anybody. I do it all the time. I do it, I guess, for a living. But the deal is that writing, you're out in the dark, and what I want is a moment that carries. I know I can get this moment with the four kids in the back of this old car. I have an old 56 Chevrolet that I put back together,
mm-hmm.
and I'm driving these kids out there. I've got some direct dialogue, which I've harbored away, and for my notes, and I can carry the moment. And I'll get a page and a half out of that, and I'll be in. Now, where's it going? Is it about all the other things that are going on in my life? Well, you always, as a writer, I think you know, I'm going to just say this and see if it makes sense. I think you know more than you could actually say. You have more hidden data that you've almost got to come across it in the dark with your headlights before you understand it was there already. And so you find a lot of things out. On all of my stories, I've only known the endings of, and this is contrary to the way some people work, but similar to others, that 95% of my work, I go in, I convince myself of a moment enough to carry, I know where to put my left foot, I create something that's believable enough to put my right foot, and I proceed that way until I find the surprise, until I find the next thing. Writing is about staying in the room, and staying in the room is about tolerating not knowing. You've got to be able to, writing what you know, listen, send me a plot, I'll type it up. You know, I'm good for you. But this whole idea of exploring a moment in such a way that you might find that true thing you didn't exactly know, that's really what I've been trying to do.
Hmm.
So,
well, what about then, speaking of endings, what about beginnings? Are your beginnings, the beginnings that we read in the Hotel Eden, for instance, are these where you started? Is this where you've started these stories, or is that after the draft and you come back and you say, no, the beginning's really here?
No, yeah, exactly. The beginnings always change. You always get to the threads per inch change. And so you you change the density. I rewrite the end. I mean, I rewrite like crazy. Rewriting, of course, is that other thing. Then you do bring in all the critical skills and all that. You consult with yourself as best you can. But I could point to five or six stories that you always tighten it. You start as close to the engagement, what I call the busyness. You get in, get started,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to, I'll write 44 pages to get 20, and usually that means the first four I was getting up to speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you bet, I work and work and work on my work. I love to revise. I go at it with big sticks. It isn't polishing. I don't go out there with a Windex and a rag. I go out with instruments. I love it. Because you're safe then. You made it. You're across the river. You gasped and you're dirty and you came out where you didn't think you would, but you made it.
Do you revise as you go along or do you wait till you have a draft?
I do not revise as I go along. And in fact, I will not even change someone's names. I've had people change sex in the story that it wasn't, that's right, it's a woman. His editor's a woman. So of course she is. But I don't go back, you know. I'll get the draft. The draft is always on other colored paper. I print on blue paper because I've run off to trips and readings before with the wrong papers in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned to print on blue paper, and then I pencil edit. I read aloud, all that other stuff that writers do before I come around. And then there's a point at which I just say, close, close, close. That's okay, good, stop.
Mm.
And I don't, that then it's done. That's the end.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Ron Carlson, author of The Hotel Eden. You have been published in the top magazines, as well as, of course, being an author. How difficult was it for you to get published, or did you start at the top? Did you start sending your stories to Harper's and say, you know what, it's going to happen here or nowhere?
I've written for everybody, and the answer to the question is this, that I've never written a story for market. I never wrote a story for anybody. I never met an editor before they published my work. So that's a privilege. You know, that's part of the reason I was born in Utah and I lived in Arizona. I mean, for Pete's sakes, I'm famous in Utah. You know, I picked the wrong state. But the deal is that, I wrote the stories and they are my stories. I mean, I tell my students and I tell anybody at a workshop or whatever, I say, if you're writing for somebody else, stop. And if you're writing something that someone else could write, let them. And if between the two somewhere, you'll find the real material for your struggle, the book that if you're dying to write it, you should write. And so I've written these stories. They're idiosyncratic. It's tough. I wouldn't have wanted to review my books because in each of the three collections, there's a range of work from the real comic to very serious. But they've honored that. I mean, I've been celebrated for my range as opposed to scolded, which I appreciate. I published in local magazines, you know, throughout the Intermountain West, and I taught in Connecticut for years at a prep school, which was interesting, such an alien place for us. And I published in local places, then I sent things around, and then I've had, I wrote a story called The Chromium Hook, and I wrote it really for my son Nick. It's a Halloween story, and it's based on the old urban legend about the hook on Lover's Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And these two characters from Minneapolis recently made it into a little movie, a 30-minute festival film. They've had all the fun, but so I wrote the story. It was an indulgence, and I thought, well, that really was the most characteristic story that I've written for years. I wrote it in the mid-90s, and we sent it to Harper's, and Harper said, oh, we want the story. We love the story. And I had the strangest thing when they wrote me the letter. I thought, well, that's their problem. I mean, do you see? I mean, it's so pleasing. I mean, I'm glad. But, I mean, people still come up to me and say, well, yeah, I saw the story. I liked it, but what was it? You know, so that's okay, too. I mean, I'm not, I think writing, not having to write for market has been a privilege, and it's really been part of the ongoing investigation. That I'm looking at what a story might be. And that's why, I mean, I know for a fact the story I've begun now. I'll get it. I don't know what it'll be. And writing it is no easier than the stories I wrote 4 years ago. I mean, it's real interesting that way. I'm not, you know, It'd be nice to be James Michener and have a staff of six looking up the stuff and say, no, no, not till chapter four. But I don't, you know, I'd rather do this. This is what I'm, so I'm still working in a way the way I was all through these stories.
Well, are you thinking about things like theme and premise when you start writing, or is it really, again, just this an idea, an image, an experience, the valet?
It's almost never theme. And I had a wonderful time with David Gooderson talking about this, but because he was very, very, he starts with his theme and works down. And very pointedly, I mean, he came out of teaching high school with the fact that high school students loved Romeo and Juliet and To Kill a Mockingbird, and so then, and thereby he wrote Snow Falling on Cedars, and you can see it reflected there. But mm-hmm. what he did that I don't see most people who start with theme do is he really got the particulars. And that wonderful snow against the window, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't. I don't start with theme at all. I start a story like I started the Hotel Eden with an, I wanted to get that the room, that strange hotel room we were in so many years ago, and mm-hmm. all the way the story turned, the way this best friend of mine turned out to be the bad guy, I felt great trepidation when I finally sent the book to him. And, but he's a screenwriter, so he understands everything has to happen. And then... And in, you know, I could tell you each of the stories in that book how they faked me out. I want to believe the last sentence I wrote so I can go on to the next one, and sometimes you get a riff and about 5% of your stories I think are kind of gifts. You write them and you wake up. I mean, you don't wake up, but 4 days you kind of crawl away from the desk and you think, I think that's finished, and it turns out to be finished. You couldn't explain it, but there it is. Hmm. Other stories you have a little more control over.
Yes. If you just joined us, you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and at KUCI.org, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guest is Ron Carlson. He's been with us since 5 and will continue on with us until the end. Ron, will you read to us?
Absolutely. Is there a story that you'd like, or... should I just try something here?
Try something.
Okay.
I like them all.
Okay, great. What I'll do is, I'll read you that first section from, since we talked about, you know what I'll do? I'll read you the first paragraph of Zandusit Second, the baseball book, baseball story.
All right.
This is a story that started hard as a premise, and when I came into it, I thought, well, that potentially could be comic. And then the reason this first sentence is, it's the longest first sentence I've ever written, is because I wanted to create an inventory that then would lead me forward.
All right.
So this is called Zandusit Second. Zandus is the name of a baseball player, Eddie Zandus. By his 33rd birthday, a gray May day, which found him having a warm cup of spiced tea on the terrace of the Bayside Inn in Annapolis, Maryland, with Caroline Menninger, a 19-year-old woman he had hired out of the Bethesda Hilton Turntable Lounge at 11 o'clock that morning. Eddie Zandus had killed 11 people and had that reputation, was famous for killing people, really the most famous killer of the day. His photograph in the sports section every week or so, and somewhere in the article the phrase 11 people or 11 fatalities. In fact, the word 11 now had that association first, the number of the dead. And in all the Major League Baseball parks, his full name could be heard every game day in some comment, the gist of which would be, popcorn and beer for $10.50, that's bad, but just be glad Eddie Zandus isn't here, for he'd kill you for sure. And the vendors would slide the beer across the counter and say, watch out for Eddie, which had come to supplant, here you go, or have a nice day, in conversations even away from the ballparks. So that's the first sentence of that story. And, when I talk about it, of course, the premise was, what if there had been a baseball player who killed people with foul balls? And how would that be? And baseball keeps creeping into my stories. I have about 3, which isn't really very many, but here, this story really is about the nature of regret. And I'll go on a minute. I'll just finish this first paragraph. Okay. Everywhere he was that famous. Even this young woman, who has been working out of the Hilton for the past 8 months, not reading the papers and only watching as much TV as one might watch in rented rooms in the early afternoon or late evening, not really news hours, even she knows his name, though she can't remember why she knows it, And she finally asks him, her brow a furrow, "Eddie Van Deuce, are you on television, an actor?" And he smiles, raising the room service teacup, but it's not a real smile. It is the placeholder expression he's been using for 4 years now, since he first hit a baseball into the stands and it struck and killed a college sophomore, a young man the papers were quick to point out who was a straight-A student majoring in chemistry, and it is the kind of smile that makes him look nothing but old, a person who has seen it all and is now waiting for it all to be over. And in his old man's way, he is patient through the next part, a talk he has had with many people all around the country, letting them know that he is simply Eddie Van Deuce, the third baseman for the Orioles, who has killed several people with foul balls. It has been a pernicious series of accidents, really, though he won't say that.
Now,
go ahead.
Well, just you said earlier that this was premise heavy.
Yeah.
To begin with, and
sure.
And also about regret. And how did those two things coincide in this story, Van Deuce?
Well,
second?
I was just going to follow it. I mean, I didn't know what it would be. What do you do? What happens when you do something wrong that you can you control? I didn't know what this was about either. This story was so fun for me because I got to page 7. I remember the draft. I'm going to read you one more paragraph, then answer the question.
Okay.
This is a 7-line paragraph. She already knows that he's not there for sex. After an hour, she can tell by the manner, the face, and he has a beautiful actor's face, which has been stunned with the kind of ruin by his bad luck and the weight of bearing responsibility for what he has done as an athlete. He's in the 2,000 afternoons of this new life, and the loneliness seems to have a physical gravity. He's hired her because it would have been impossible not to. He's hired her to survive the afternoon.
Mm.
So when I got there's three scenes. There's one in the motel room, which I took a long time with. I just thought, since you don't know where you're going, I mean, one of the premises of that I have as a fiction writer is, since I don't know where I'm going, no hurry. And so I let it pool. I see a lot of stories that run right along the surface as if they're afraid the ice would break, and the fact is if they stood still it would break.
Mm.
And so I let it pool and so I stayed a minute, and then the second scene in the car, and the third scene in the ballpark. But in the car, I was riding along that day, and I wrote a sentence. And indulge you, I'll read you the sentence.
All right.
Because it's a longer story, a longer sentence. But you can see I was just working that way. It's in the middle of the story after a space break, and it says, her name is Carolyn. On the drive north, Carol Ann Menninger says one thing that stays with Eddie Van Deuce after he drops her at her little blue Geo in the Hilton parking lot, and after he has dressed and played 3 innings of baseball before a crowd of 24,000, the stadium a third full under low clouds this early in the season, with the Orioles going ho-hum and school not out yet. And she says it like so much she has said in the 6 hours he has known her, right out of the blue as they cruise north from Annapolis on Route 2. Can you hear me? I'm avoiding, this sentence goes on and on because I don't know what she said. And that's exactly the way I was working here. And the prepositional phrases are just stacked to the end of this. So listen to this last phrase. It says that right out of the blue as they cruise north from Annapolis on Route 2 in his thick silver Mercedes, a car he thinks nothing of and can afford not to think of, under the low sullen skies that bless and begrudge the very springtime hedgerows, the car speeds past. And, well, I don't write that way, but, I mean, I don't mind the sentence, it carries for me, but the deal is that, what'd she say? Okay, what did she say that he would remember later in the batter's box?
Uh-huh.
And I've had some funny moments in the batter's box. When I was a kid, I mean, I'd remember things that my English teacher said that morning, and it wasn't a help, I'll tell you what. And it took me, so that was page 7 in the draft, singular double-spaced, I don't know, I'm working along. I found out what she said on page 11,
mm-hmm.
And I found out, the only way I found out, and I guess this is the lesson, by staying there. I mean, I didn't know, and I stayed till I found out, and I'll tell you, Barbara, there have been times when I haven't stayed. I mean, sometimes you leave the room. You just can't bear it. You think, I don't know, I don't like this, it's complicated, writing's hard. Who said this was fun? There must be a sandwich somewhere.
So you just keep yourself glued to the chair.
When I come in, I'm committed. I don't play with it. I mean, I know the days I'll work and I know the days I don't, like I said. And once you're in a project, when you're in love with something, you find a way to see her. And that's the way I feel about this work, though love may not be the right emotion, but it's that feeling, and you're going to get it. You want to get it to see what it is.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Ron Carlson, author of The Hotel Eden. Speaking of these long sentences, I recall a story of yours that I saw in Harper's, I believe it was, and sure wish I could find it. I looked today. I had cut it out.
Oh,
I kept
it was
this
one ad.
What was it?
Wasn't it the woman on the beach?
It might be the woman on the beach. It was a couple. It was this couple, and it was all one sentence, I think.
Yeah, it was. It was I wrote it as the premise was a one ad.
Okay.
And it was woman wanted for long walks on the beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The we did a lot with Harper's was good in terms of their reading section, and they looked for me for a while, and then we did some things together. I do a lot of odd bits.
That was wonderful. You know, it was just such a wonderful example of what something else a story can be. Which is, you know, it was a little shorter. It was pretty short, as I recall.
Yeah, it is. You want me to read you the first sentence? The first sentence for the first page?
I'd love it.
Okay, it's called Single Woman for Long Walks on the Beach. And it is a one-ed. Looking for a young woman for the chance to exchange introductory remarks and help on homework, particularly math, social studies, perhaps the term project, the triptych display about continental drift, share pencils, markers, erasers, including all those in shapes of animals, and lunch with the possibility of swapping the store-bought Aunt Dorothy's big rolls for homemade tomato sandwiches stuffed with slices of sharp cheddar, merging our potato chips on a paper plate, talking about our childhood until the bell rings, keeping this up, lunching, both in cafeteria and on the front steps of the school, until laughing one day we decide to skip quickly away in my car. A lark, but that's what we share, this lark. Driving the strange daytime streets while all our classmates suffer under the confused rule of Mrs. Delman Rinko and her versions of what happened when the great land masses first pulled apart. Finally ended up at the Bluebird Drive-In, empty in the late afternoon, and sharing two malts, the strawberry and the vanilla, the feeling encircling us certainly something, but not something easily identifiable or given a name, just something new. And in that place, deciding to try for the senior prom, laughing at it in fun, what a goofy schoolboy thing to do, but also laughing from that feeling and, well, joy. And in 2 weeks, another set of lunches, sharing the senior prom, including me picking you up in my freshly washed Bel Air, and meeting your mother and your sister really giving me the once-over, and you in a dress that is actually pink, believably pink, a pink that rescues that color once and for all, and then dancing at the prom, our first touch really, carefully committed in the old gymnasium, visiting with your friends and some of my friends, and dancing and sharing, then the long walk to the car, but knowing as we felt the night air fall on our warm faces as we left the building, that everything has changed now, and the feeling we had at the Bluebird Drive-In has now become a real thing that we still don't have a name for, but we are forever different in the car, talking now about college, not kissing, afraid to really, talking about the future and pledging to write to each other when we go away to college, which we will do. Daily, handwritten letters full of the heartbreaking news of classes, social life, every mention of another person, male or female, engendering faint but genuine pangs of what we will only be able to call jealousy, and longing all sent by post over a period long enough for the price of a stamp to go up 3 cents. And then meeting again at a graduation summer geology seminar, seeing everything by now quite clearly, as the entire conference, all of geology, the very world disappears, and we go as we never have gone to bed together that noon without words, though they will come along, among them some we will be happy to pronounce, I do, as we're wed, two young people fresh and strong and ready for the next thing, though it will be no single thing now, but 5 libraries, 2 extensive research projects, a baby, and then another, 4 apartments in a house, and then another house in a position. Yes, geology with solar research, this being for an energy firm in a large Midwestern city, and a basketball hoop on the front of the garage, along with a free throw line in chalk, and growing children, a girl and a boy who will annoy the neighbors into knowing their names, and there will be success, not small success, in the careers, some original work recognized in material well-being, some weekend afternoons with the sound of a basketball in the driveway, we'll eat sandwiches in the kitchen, and with the desire alive in the room, it will be as if one time were all time, and we were back on the lawn at the school where we met. And then with the kids gone, we'll clean the garage, the stuff we're storing, all the photos and the schoolwork, and we will share the lovely sound of the broom on the cement floor. But time will turn for me. That's part of this deal. 75% of all women outlive their husbands, and they'll be nearer of you sitting at my bedside as a simple fact. This is later, but still too soon by my measure. And the days will wash away, your hand on my arm, some, and some days just the yellow light on the wall. This is when I'll ask to walk on the beach and expect you to talk to me, to walk me out in story along a beach. Let's make it on an island, far from the grinding continents. You pick it, Kailua, Waikiki, Waimanalo, or further shorelines, and fill in the details, please, and the texture of the sand, hard, pack, or plush, and I'll want to surf what there is, timid or crazed, and the smell, of course, and the walk itself, which direction and how far, with me on the ocean side most of the time as we swing our arms and talk the way we've always talked, the sweet real pleasure of reason and speculation, and whether we're barefoot or not, my cuff's wet, we'll walk on the beach. That's what we signed up for. And when it grows dark, we can stroll back all the way, and we can dine by candlelight. There are never enough candles in a life. So there it is, late in the day, a walk on the beach in this tray of hospital lasagna in the candlelight.
Hmm.
So that's
that story knocks me out, I'll tell you.
I got halfway through. I just thought, well, we'd push through. That took a little minute, but good.
Yeah, that's just incredible. How did this story find its way?
Well, we had, in 1993, Elaine and I, my wife and I had, all of our friends were women, and they were all our age. There was like six of them. And we'd have these gatherings, and we didn't notice it at first. We'd just have a party, and it would be just women. And so we talked a lot about, like, who can they meet? How can they meet? And I helped one woman who married a man, and now they live in Hawaii. But I helped her write her one ad, and we were trying to come up with, you know, all that. We were playing off all the silly genre stuff that you see, but then what would you say, and how would you say it?
Mm-hmm.
I used to, when I remodeled my houses, I had an old house, and I remodeled it. So every time I put the furniture, my most successful ads were always, I put, old range, two problems. And people always say, what are the problems? You know, and it was so you get, it was the best spot. First of all, it was true. And second of all, it opened the discussion. You didn't say, runs good, you know. Runs good? There's no way to talk about it. What do you mean?
Right.
Oh, is it real good? Anyway, that's where that came from.
Hmm. Wow.
So,
great story.
Thank you. I appreciate you letting me read the whole. I didn't think we'd get to read something from beginning to end, but yeah. That'll be, I'm doing a book. I have a book from Picador next June or July, and that will be there's three or four small pieces in there. I did a piece called Disclaimer, too, which is based on the premise of a fiction disclaimer. It's about the same length.
Mm. Well,
and
you have to come back with that book.
Yeah, so it's like that. But anyway, that's where they'll be, along with all this other new work that I have.
Mm. So. This is Writers on Writing, and my guest has been Ron Carlson. Now, you have judged contests as well as won them, and how do you judge contests? How do you judge the quality of a story? Do you know right away? Do you know in the first sentence whether this is a story that you want to read or not?
No, I don't think you can know in the first sentence. I mean, I'd love to be able to say that. Sometimes you can, but mostly you can't. You need to read for a while, and you can tell though. My friends who are editors, you know, these people I've known for years in New York, usually a novel gets 20 pages. I mean, by 20 pages you can tell in a novel, and you can. The texture, the posture, the largest issues are established for you. One of the things that young writers do here and get opportunities at universities is to come in and edit the lit. We have one here at Arizona State called Hayden's Ferry Review, and it's well thought of, but the people who become editors, it's pretty hard service. I mean, they come in and they say, well, I'm sure that one of every 50 stories will be publishable. Well, let's talk to them again at the end of the semester. It's lovely and it's wonderful and it's important to read all this work. But when I judge, it depends on how many, you know, if you're reading 12 novels, you read them, you know, the way you'd eat good meals. You just very, very carefully, because you understand it's going to be close. But if you're reading 273 short stories, you're almost reading for a reason to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And but there'll still be 27 of those stories that really, you'll be on page 8 before you looked up and thought, oh, wait, I'm not supposed to read this, I'm judging it. And I love that moment. I love that when the guy gets me or she gets me, and you're swept. And I've laughed about this because I was worried that when I got to be an experienced reader that I'd have diminished ability, you know, or I'd have a thicker skin, but I don't. I don't have a thicker skin. The stories, I read quarterlies all the time. They come to the house. They just rotate through. And I see a lot of stuff that's arresting. But reading is, it requires, because you're going to say no to so many people. And I've had people say no to me. I need to understand that what that is about, and how, I mean, I need to substantiate that. It's not, you don't do it casually.
Do you think contests are good ways for writers to get their work out there, as opposed to, say, submitting something to an editor at a magazine or journal?
I don't think contests are as good a way. The contests are good in that a lot of people, it kicks people out of bed. They say, oh my God, it's due May 1st, you know, and they type it up. But I want something in the writer to get her out of bed and say it's due May 1st. Mm-hmm. What is it in her heart that wants the piece so much that she wants to read it? That's what we try to train ourselves for. But so contests get a lot of stuff typed up. But if a magazine, say, Carolina Quarterly had a contest, their number of submissions they'd have as opposed to a regular issue would be quadrupled.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first part of it. And then I just don't know. I mean, I think that there's I'm not a big fan of it. I'm a big fan of writing stories, and then I'm a big fan of publishing locally. A lot of the stories that were in News of the World, I wrote for a little. My friend Karen Shepherd, who was later in the House of Representatives in Salt Lake City, was one of our. She had this monthly. It was a woman's business networking magazine. It was called Network, and I said, "Do you want to do some fiction? I'd like to write some fiction for my neighbors." And she said, yeah, I challenge you to write a Christmas story. So I wrote her a Christmas story. And then I did about 8 stories for them, and then which then went on and were published elsewhere and are in News of the World. The mm-hmm. one, the H Street Sledding Record is on that selected shorts from time to time. I know that people in California hear it because
yes, definitely.
I've gotten letters. But so I believe in local. I'd love to be in the supermarket and have somebody looking, trying to figure out what 1%, what is 1% milk? And someone will say, hey, I saw that story. You know, I really like that. I loved that period. There was a period in the mid-80s when I felt like I was writing for my neighbors, and I did some of my most honest work. I mean, I stopped, you know, this whole notion of, when I was a sophomore, when I was 20 years old, my college roommate said, you'll write a good story when your father-in-law likes it. And my father-in-law was a guy who didn't have any books in his house. He was a pilot and a fisherman and a businessman, outdoorsman, and he was rough and tumble, and I thought, oh, no, I'm college educated. I'm, you know, not, but, you know, every year, as I told you, now he was exactly right. Those are the stories I want. I want a story that's believable, that has enough basis. I don't mean big, tough stuff happens, trucks tip over and fires, but fundamental, something believable.
Well, you mentioned the word honest,
yeah.
And I wonder if you could say a bit more about that.
Well, just that... I'm not hiding behind any scaffolding of subtlety or sophistication or even symbolism. You have a story, things happen, the people, of course, character is your character is what you're delivering by way of an outer story, the events, which also need to be convincing. And so it's, I don't know. I'm afraid of oversimplifying. Am I afraid of that? I don't know. But no, the whole notion of just saying, does the story stand up,
mm-hmm.
or does it only appreciate? Is it a little quote unquote graduate school? And I think the story has to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
I love this. Years ago, someone wrote in her comprehensive exams here. This wonderful young writer said, "Da da da, this and that." And she said, "But after all, they're going to read your story to find out what happened."
Mm-hmm.
And I've never forgotten that it is, it's what we all. I want to read a story that makes me want to get out my sleeping bag, or you know, like that whole fellow feeling of wanting a big plate of fettuccine, or to step out the back door and wipe your forehead with a clean kerchief, you know, or like that.
Yeah.
And it's still, isn't that simple? But I don't know.
It makes sense.
It's where the pleasure is for me.
We're at the end of our time, and you know, I have a million more things I'd like to talk to you about.
Well, I'm so glad to talk to you. I enjoyed it. I hope we said something that was interesting. I have no idea what happened.
Well, it's interesting to me, so I think it's great. You're great, and when your new book comes out, I would love you to come back and,
oh, sweet,
and talk about that.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'll
and I'll keep these questions I didn't get to ask you and
anything.
Ask you then.
Certainly. Well, I hope between now and then at some point we get a chance to meet. And good luck with the program.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
All righty.
Thanks.
Bye bye. Bye. That was Ron Carlson, author of The Hotel Eden and other books, and his stories are everywhere. And hope you've enjoyed this one as much as I have. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And if you'd like to receive a weekly email notice of who's going to be on, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net or go to my website, writersonwriting.com. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Jessamine West, who said, "Fiction reveals truths that reality obscures." I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I do thank you for listening.